Welcome to Talking History. This is your host, Brian LeBeau of Creighton University's Department of History. Who can forget the jubilation with which the world welcomed the collapse of the Soviet Union and the high expectations for the future of such a great nation freed from what most saw as the debilitating effects of its communist regime? Now, less than a decade after those heady days, we face the possible collapse of the new Russia and fear what will follow. What happened? How do we account for this failure? Is anyone to blame for losing Russia, as some analysts have put it? We'll answer these and other related questions in a moment. But before we do that, let's look back at an important event that occurred this week in history. During this week in 1925, 24-year-old John T. Scopes, a high school biology teacher in Dayton, Tennessee, was arrested for violating a state law that made it illegal to teach theories contrary to accepted interpretations of the biblical account of man's creation, meaning evolution. What followed was a highly publicized and controversial trial, one of the first cases to be covered live by radio, that pit religion against science, state interest against individual freedoms, and two equally famous and passionate lawyers, William Jennings Bryan and Clarence Darrow, against each other. The most dramatic moment in what has come to be known as the Monkey Trial occurred when Bryan took the stand and was questioned by Darrow as to his views on the Bible, creation, and evolution. Scopes was convicted and fined $100. On appeal, the Tennessee State Supreme Court acquitted Scopes on a technicality, but upheld the constitutionality of the law, which was not repealed until 1967. Turning to items of interest in the news, three frozen mummies found high in the Andes Mountains of Argentina may yield important insights into the culture and religion of the Inca Empire, which stretched across 2,500 miles of South America from what is now Colombia to Chile, until it was destroyed by Spanish conquistadors in the early 1500s. Items buried with the bodies of the two boys and one girl indicate that they were probably victims of ritual human sacrifice. 18 similarly placed mummies have been found in the region in recent years, but this find is especially important because the mummies' internal organs, blood, and even body hair are perfectly preserved. Scientists hope to apply modern DNA techniques to the mummies in order to learn more about the lives of these mysterious ancient people. And on a more modern note, declassified files from the Nixon presidency are causing historians to review the nature and depth of the late president's relationship with Chinese officials. Expressing his satisfaction with Nixon's commitment to normal relations with China and his historic visit to Beijing, Premier Chou Enlai privately told Nixon that he hoped Nixon would be reelected in 1972 and that National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger would remain an advisor to the president. As recent news reports suggest, Chinese interest in American presidential campaigns continues. You're listening to Talking History. Just what are we to make of the recent turn of events in Russia, the great nation that in the early years of this decade rose from the ruins of a collapsed Soviet Union and that now faces ruin itself? Here to help us better understand this confusing and troubling recent past is Creighton University's Terry Clark, who will be interviewing Russian specialist Peter Rutland.
The suddenness and finality with which the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991 caught scholars and politicians alike by surprise. The rancorous debate over why no one was able to forecast the demise of the Soviet Union was soon replaced by the opportunity for constructing a new Russia and a new world order liberated from superpower confrontation and the threat of nuclear war. However, the Russian transition from an authoritarian state with a centrally planned economy to a free market democracy has been a troubled one. Moreover, the collapse of the Russian ruble and banking system in August of last year has led to the emergence of a newer, even more rancorous debate over who lost Russia. Here today to help us understand what lies behind these events and debates is Dr. Peter Rutland, professor of government at Wesleyan University. Professor Rutland is the editor of the annual survey of Eastern Europe and the former Soviet Union. Welcome to our show, Professor Rutland.
Hello.
What is this debate, who lost Russia, all about?
Well, the who lost Russia debate is echoing the who lost China debate of the 1950s, although it doesn't have the same urgency, because in the Cold War, there was a direct threat to America coming from the failure to interpret China, whereas it's not so clear what is the direct threat to America from the mistakes that have been made in policy towards Russia.
I see. What is your position in this debate?
My own view is that the collapse of the Soviet state was a process with very deep historical roots, and there's really not much that the United States or the West could have done to slow down that process or to speed up that process. So we were really spectators to a historic cataclysm over which we had very little control and over which the Soviet leadership, as Mikhail Gorbachev found out, also had very little control.
These deep historical roots, could you elaborate a little bit more on what you have in mind?
Well, the Soviet experiment, of course, began in 1917, trying to create a new, historically unique political system based on the commitment to building a communist utopia, based on abolishing the market, abolishing money, and based on creating a multi-ethnic confederation where ethnic identity would also be abolished. And that's an astonishing agenda. And what's even more amazing is that they managed to keep that illusion going for 75 years. So it's not so much remarkable that the Soviet Empire collapsed in 1991. What's remarkable is that it lasted that long.
What do you believe is the essence of why the Soviet Union collapsed?
Well, I think that the basic model, as it were, that Lenin tried to introduce was kind of fatally flawed. And anything that lasts for seven decades obviously has some things going for it. But even so, using the benefit of hindsight, now we know, as it were, that the model was fatally flawed. And if you look at the events of 1988 to 1991, the end game of the Soviet Union, you can see that a key flaw was the ethnic dimension, that Russians, ethnic Russians, only made up about 53% of the population, and the Soviet Union was split up into 15 ethnically designated republics. And as soon as the central political authority started to weaken, as soon as a leader such as Gorbachev came to power, who was not willing to use massive force to hold the Soviet Union together, we saw nationalist movements breaking out in Lithuania, in Armenia, and those peoples just didn't want to be part of the same state with the Russians. And so I think it was the ethnic factor was the key factor which made the Soviet Union ungovernable.
I recall shortly after the collapse of the Soviet Union that there was a very heated debate about why scholars in particular were not able to forecast that collapse. Can you describe that debate for us?
Yes, well, it was a very heated debate, as you say, and it came on two levels. On one level, there were attacks on the Central Intelligence Agency in particular, because the CIA for many years had been giving us all very inflated estimates of the size of the Soviet GDP. And they'd also extrapolated weapons systems, which seemed to be qualitatively not as good as the CIA were saying. So the CIA had been kind of boosting the Soviet threat. Maybe they did it for reasons of national security, to be doubly sure that the U.S. was safe. Maybe they were simply based on ignorance of the real weaknesses of the Soviet economy in practice. So that was one side of the debate, was criticizing the CIA for exaggerating the strength of the Soviet economy. And the second side of the debate was more interesting from the academic point of view, which was connected to the failure of academics to even imagine that the Soviet Union could collapse. That they, with very few exceptions, 95% of the Western academic community didn't even discuss whether Soviet collapse was feasible until 1989, 1990.
Why was that the case? Why would a community of scholars that we expect to be imaginative and imagine all sorts of scenarios, why would they fail to take this possibility into consideration?
Well, it's a fascinating question. I think it has to do with the simple fact that the Soviet Union had been around for 75 years. longer than the lifetime of most academics, for sure. And it was part of the furniture. It was just part of the landscape. Moreover, it seemed to be a very stable and very strong system. The Soviet system had pulled up Russia to be a superpower, equal in nuclear weapons to the United States. And from the outside looking in, there seemed to be very few cracks in the monolith. So the Soviet police and KGB were still able to crack down on dissidents, were still able to instill fear in the population such that public demonstrations were essentially non-existent until 1988. So it seemed to be a very long-standing and very stable system. So the academics just started from the premise that the Soviet Union is here to stay.
Do you think the debate about whether or not we foresaw the collapse has in any way been helpful to, say, our studies of Russia today?
I would say it probably hasn't been very helpful. There was a kind of couple of years of breastbeating and mutual recrimination between academics, and then that kind of died down. And what's made the situation even more difficult is that events since 1991 in Russia have been very, very confusing. And so the problem of failing to predict the Soviet collapse has been overtaken by our failure to understand what's happening in Russia right now. So these more urgent problems about what's happening in Russia today have kind of pushed out that older debate about why we didn't understand the Soviet collapse was imminent.
Let's turn to Russia then after the Soviet collapse. What challenges faced the new Russia in 1991 after the collapse of the Soviet Union?
Well, they had challenges on many fronts, three fronts in particular. First of all, they had to deal with the breakup of the Soviet Union into 15 new states, and they had to create a new nation-state in Russia, which is more difficult than it might appear, because Russia had never been an ethnically based nation-state. It had always been part of a multinational empire or a multinational Soviet Union. So that was the first challenge, to define the national interests and national institutions of Russia. The second challenge was to create a functioning democracy with elections and parties and a parliament and a presidency. And the third task was, of course, to create a market economy out of the ruins of the centrally planned economy. And any one of those three tasks would have been more than enough for most governments. And Boris Yeltsin's administration had to tackle all three of those simultaneously, and it proved too much.
Which of those particular, or which of those three transitions do you believe to have been the most problematic?
Well, that's a difficult choice. The political transition has probably been the most successful in the sense that they've had two elections to parliament and one election to a president. And those elections were more or less free, and they took place more or less according to the rules. So the political transition is not perfect by any means, but it's better than one could have hoped for, I think. 10 years ago, nobody would have expected that the Soviet Union would see democratic elections at all. Second most successful has been the breakup of the Soviet Union into 15 states. But those 15 states, so far, thank goodness, have avoided going to war with each other. The Soviet Union didn't break up in the same way that Yugoslavia broke up. Boris Yeltsin is not Slobodan Milosevic. He didn't use the power of the Russian army to try to gather back the 20 million Russian ethnics who live outside the borders of the Russian Federation. So the fact that the Soviet Union broke up without a major war, apart from the war within Tajikistan or the war within Chechnya, the fact that there was no major interstate war is something we should be thankful for. So I would put the ethnic breakup as the second most successful. And the least successful has been the economic transition, because GDP in Russia has collapsed by about 50%. Poverty level has gone through the ceiling. Corruption, lawlessness are rife. And people are now very, very pessimistic about the prospects for getting out of the hole that they've fallen into.
When Russia became a new state following the collapse of the Soviet Union, in fact, Russia became one of 15 new states, there was a lot of talk that Russia itself would also dismember. Do you see that as a real or potential threat still?
There has been a lot of talk about the breakup of the Russian Federation, but I myself think that talk is exaggerated, that the ethnic minorities within the Russian Federation, the Tatars and the Bashkirs, the Muslim peoples on the central Volga, they make up about 18% of the total population, quite a sizable group. But those non-Russian ethnic groups are all located deep in the heart of Russian territory, and none of them have an external border. And without a border with an external country, I don't think it's serious to await any of those regions to secede from the Russian Federation and become independent states. So likewise, people talk about the Russian Far East as being possibly breaking off from Russia. I don't see that as a likely prospect either, because there's only 8 million Russians living in the Far East, and they're outnumbered by Chinese in Manchuria alone. There are 100 million Chinese. So Russians in the Far East provinces, they may chafe under the controls from Moscow, but they would be completely swamped by Chinese population migration and economic pressure if they tried to become independent. So I think the breakup of the Russian Federation is not very likely. The one area where we have seen a lot of conflict and where we'll continue to see conflict inside Russia is the North Caucasus, where the terrible war in Chechnya and violence breaking out in neighboring states of Dagestan and North Ossetia, the whole series of ethnic minorities in the North Caucasus are really torn with internal conflicts, and also Chechens suffering from the attack that Moscow launched in 1994.
Last year's ruble collapse caught a lot of people in the United States by surprise. What were the causes of the collapse?
The ruble collapse has several causes. The Russian ruble was made convertible in 1992, and in 1995, the government managed to introduce a stable exchange rate and pledged to keep the value of the ruble within a fixed corridor. The problem was, even though their monetary policy was sound, their fiscal policy was unbalanced, and the government continued to run a deficit. It was spending more than it was collecting in taxes. And so that fiscal imbalance was a threat to the stability of the monetary system. Now, in 1996 and 1997, the government was able to bridge the gap by borrowing from international banks. And this created a debt pyramid. They had to borrow more and more to start paying off the interest and principal on the previous debt. So by 1998, they're spending about 30% of government revenue is going on interest payments for earlier debt. So they constructed this debt pyramid because they were unable to increase taxes or lower government spending. That was the main cause, I think. Additional factors were the collapse in the price of oil, which began in late 1997 and fell about 40% over the next year. And half of Russia's exports are oil and gas. So that the collapse in the price of oil really cut into Russia's hard currency earnings.
Has the United States, in your opinion, done much to help Russia?
Oh, we've been doing a great deal to help Russia. We've probably put in $15 to $20 billion worth of aid and soft credits since 1991. Russia has accumulated a total of $50 billion worth of new debt since 1991. And that doesn't include the fact that we've rolled over payments due on the old Soviet Union's debt, which is another $100 billion. So just looked at it in terms of sheer cash, critics who argue that there's been no Marshall Plan for Russia are simply wrong. I think the money has been there. It's just not worked. The challenges of trying to impose order out of the chaos of the former Soviet Union couldn't be solved with money alone. You need many years, many decades even, of building institutions before you can expect the situation to really stabilize.
In the remaining few seconds, let me ask you if we've lost an opportunity here, or is it yet possible that we might see the emergence of a stable democratic Russia? And if so, what can the United States do to help facilitate that?
Well, even though almost 10 years have passed since the collapse of the Soviet Union, I would say in a historical sense it's still too early to judge or condemn U.S. policy. I think we need to remain engaged. We need to remain in contact, helping with the Russians, but not with exaggerated expectations that we're going to solve their problems for them, because the solution to Russia's problems will only be found by the Russians themselves. And we can just be a kind of helpful spectator to this process, I would suggest.
Thank you for being our guest today, Professor Rutland. You've been listening to Professor Peter Rutland, Department of Government at Wesleyan University.
American diplomatic involvement in Eastern Europe took a more serious turn recently when the United States joined its NATO allies in the bombing of Serbia. What the long-term results of the bombing on Yugoslavia are to be remain to be seen. So, too, does the effect of U.S. military action in Serbia on U.S.-Russian relations. Here to provide his perspective on that subject in our op-ed of the week is Michael McFowell. McFowell is a senior associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Washington, D.C., and professor of political science at Stanford University.
Although few in Washington have noticed, U.S.-Russian relations have entered a new era with the NATO bombing of Serbia. Before Serbia, anti-Americanism in Russia was an elite sentiment. After Serbia, anti-Americanism is rapidly becoming a populist cause that penetrates every segment of society, including, most ominously, young people. Anti-American sentiment in Russia is nothing new. What is new about this crisis is who is now joining the anti-American chorus. Traditionally, Russia's foreign policy elite rant about U.S. hegemony, while Russian grandmothers show up at anti-American demonstrations. In response to Kosovo, however, it was young people throwing beer bottles at the U.S. Embassy in Moscow and organizing university teach-ins. In a first, Russian yuppies have joined skinheads in protesting against U.S., quote, hegemony. Burned by the financial meltdown last August, Russia's young elite may no longer believe their future is best served by Western integration. Communist and nationalist leaders, of course, couldn't be more pleased. NATO bombs dropping on their Serbian brothers give them great footage for their campaign clips for the upcoming parliamentary election. Every Russian pollster and campaign consultant I've talked to predicts that the NATO bombing will enhance the electoral prospects of communist and openly fascist groups and revive the waning career of neo-nationalist Vladimir Zhirinovsky. President Boris Yeltsin also welcomes this new burst of anti-Americanism as it diverts attention away from impeachment proceedings and corruption charges levied against his administration and family. The new situation within Russia is dire. If militant anti-Western forces sweep into power after the next elections, Russian democracy may falter, economic reform will halt, and U.S.-Russian relations will take a dramatic turn for the worst. To limit this damage, the administration must rethink its strategy of engagement with Russia. The battle for Russia has moved from the diplomatic hallways to the streets of Moscow. The U.S. strategy for engagement must respond to this new battlefield terrain. In the short run, U.S. officials must articulate clearly and often the reasoning behind NATO actions in Yugoslavia. Western officials, and preferably from European and NATO members, should appear on Russian TV, write articles for Russian newspapers, and meet frequently with Russian leaders to explain NATO's mission in Serbia. Of course, the immediate reaction will be overwhelmingly negative. Saying nothing, however, fuels the belief that the U.S. has a secret, sinister plot to destroy Serbia today and Russia tomorrow. If U.S. officials do not explain their policy, Russian fascists will do it for them. In the long run, the U.S. must reinvigorate its training and exchange programs targeted at Russia's youth. The U.S. should fund thousands, not hundreds, of Russian students to study at American universities. Likewise, short-term youth exchanges should be increased dramatically and immediately. Our best propaganda for Western values is the American system and the American people. If Russia's 18-year-olds turn against the U.S., then the NATO campaign in Serbia will truly have undermined the most important U.S. strategic interest of this decade, Russian integration into the West.
You've been listening to Michael McFaul, Senior Associate at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace and Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. This is Talking History. For decades, throughout the Cold War, the Strategic Air Command headquarters near Omaha, Nebraska, stood at Ground Zero, the place most likely to be attacked first by the Soviet Union should war break out between the two superpowers. It was the nerve center, the command post, of the American nuclear arsenal. A new museum has been erected to preserve the memory of the Strategic Air Command, and here to tell you about it is Talking History's Cindy Workman.
Located just off Interstate 80 in Ashland, Nebraska, midway between Omaha and Lincoln is the Strategic Air Command Museum. The 50-acre museum is home to many aircraft and artifacts from the wars and provides a state-of-the-art shelter for some of the nation's most important aviation treasures and memories of the peacekeeping effort. Entering the museum, you are greeted by the SR-71 Blackbird, the world's fastest plane, suspended in the middle of the glass atrium. There's a gift shop and views of the hangars and restoration shop from the upper level. More displays in the theater are located on the lower level, along with a snack bar that provides a view of the restoration area. There are many different types of aircraft on display at the SAC Museum, and special programs are scheduled year-round. There is a children's interactive gallery that many adults find irresistible as well. The museum is open daily from 9 a.m. to 6 p.m.
Thank you, Cindy. And finally, turning to our weekly segment, Coming Attractions. In merely a four-year span during the Great Patriotic War, as they called it, the Russians lost an estimated 27 million people. Long shrouded by the Iron Curtain, Russia's victorious struggle against Hitler's forces is little known in the United States. But the Iron Curtain has been lifted. The Russian Central Armed Forces Museum has opened its archives to the West. And from the archives, hundreds of artifacts have been gathered for a new exhibit titled World War II Through Russian Eyes. The exhibit runs through July 5th at San Diego's Balboa Park. And that's it for another week of Talking History. I hope you've enjoyed the show and that you will join us next week when our subject will be Renaissance astronomer Galileo. In the meantime, we invite you to send us your comments or suggestions either by email at talkinghistory@creighton.edu or by U.S. mail to Talking History, care of the Department of History at Creighton University in Omaha, Nebraska, 68178. Until next time, from the studios of KIOS-FM in Omaha, Nebraska, this is Brian LeBeau.